Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and today, in case you didn't know, is Inauguration Day for none other than Vladimir Putin, officially installed for his fourth six-year term. Will he now go on to helping Republicans retain power for another term in Congress in this country? We are lucky to have with us on this auspicious occasion President Obama's former ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul. What does he think we're in for with Russian meddling in this year's election, and what evidence might he have to prove or disprove Trump campaign collusion? Ironically, one of McFaul's goals in office was to try to build a more cooperative relationship with Russia, but with less success than he and President Obama had hoped. So now he's looking at both the current intensity in the U.S.-Russia relationship and the bigger sweep of history in a new book called From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Michael McFaul is now director of the Freeman Spolee Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, as well as author of this new book. So happy to have you here. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks for having me. Honored to be here.
So the title of the book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. How do you define hot peace?
Well, U.S.-Russian relations are at a pretty bad place right now. I think you have to go deep into the Cold War to find a time as confrontational. But it's not exactly like the Cold War. I think that's a misnomer to just say we're back to the Cold War. So I use hot peace deliberately to echo that some of the things are the same. An ideological struggle, by the way, is underway. An arms race is underway. Competing in different parts of the world through proxies is underway, but other elements are new. And that's why I use the phrase hot peace.
Is there an ideological struggle? A version that I sometimes hear is, well, the ideological struggle, communism versus capitalism, is over. All it is about power versus power.
It's about power versus power and an ideological struggle. So yes, thank goodness communism versus capitalism is over. We're not fighting that. But Vladimir Putin, for several years now, has been advocating a new ideology, a conservative, traditional, values-laden, in his mind, as he defines it, against what he calls the decadent liberal West. And he's invested in it. He's invested in radio programs and television programs and social media and bots to try to propagate those views well beyond Russia's borders.
That's why he's become a hero of the alt-right. It's
exactly.
So crazy in historical terms. If people knew the Cold War or know about the Cold War, that the head of Russia would wind up being the cultural scion of the American right.
That's exactly right. And those people, the alt-right and their ideological soulmates in Europe, in many countries in Europe, including many NATO allies, they look to Putin as their ideological leader and their physical leader, too. Like, you know, we laugh when we see him riding around with his shirt off on a horse, but that's designed deliberately as part of this ideological struggle with the West.
How much do you think that's anti-woman or feminist?
Brian, that's a great question. I think there's an element there. To what extent, I wouldn't want to speculate, but there's something there. And there's most certainly a anti-LGBT dimension to it. When I was ambassador, that was very prominent. In fact, when they had the gay games in Moscow, they asked us if they could play their basketball tournament at the embassy because they could not find another gym that would allow them to do that.
Wow.
So that is a dimension of it as well.
And you helped craft Obama's reset policy, as it was called, that you and he hoped would foster a more cooperative relationship between the U.S. and Russia. I think there was an open mic moment that Trump supporters referred to sometimes where Obama was caught on tape saying, was it to Putin himself? Don't worry, after I'm reelected, I don't have to be so tough on you.
I was with President Medvedev in Seoul, 2012.
Okay.
I was there. And let me say two things about it. So the reset policy that you described was designed, I would say not for better relations. We tried to avoid that phrase, but to get things done that were in America's national interest. So in 2010, for instance, we reduced by 30% the number of nuclear weapons allowed in the United States and Russia. That's an outcome that we thought was good for America, good for Russia. We got new sanctions on Iran. We got a new supply route to Afghanistan to reduce our dependency on Pakistan so that we could then go after Osama bin Laden in Pakistan in 2011. So the reset was all about win-win outcomes with Russia. When Putin came back, he wasn't so interested in that. He had a different view. He didn't want win-win outcomes with us. And he portrayed us as trying to overthrow his regime, because back in December 2011, there were massive demonstrations to protest a falsified parliamentary vote. First 5,500 and eventually 200,000 people on the streets of Moscow. The last time you had that many people on the streets was the year the Soviet Union collapsed, 1991. So he struck back hard, blaming Obama, America, the West, and me personally for fomenting revolution against his regime.
Huh. So when Trump seems to criticize everybody in the world in the harshest possible terms, NFL football players who kneel or sons of bitches, everything else,
yes,
but won't say anything bad about Russia, and he's called on it, his response is good relations with Russia would be a good thing, which in the context of your time in office would seem to be something that President Obama and you would at least in theory agree with.
Yeah, this is the way I describe it. He gets mixed up the means and the ends of diplomacy. So the ends of diplomacy should never be good relations. I would say that about any country, by the way, not just Russia. Like, good relations for what? So that we have a nice photo op and we say we had a nice piece of chocolate cake and everybody's friendly. And what do we get out of it? You got to reverse it. You need to define your objectives. What do we seek to accomplish in our bilateral relationship with Russia? And then devise the means for accomplishing it. Sometimes that means would be engagement and diplomacy. Sometimes it may be deterrence, containment. Another time it might be isolation. So that's, in my view, the thing that, that President Trump has mixed up in his head, and he kind of personalizes relations with all states. You know, his job is to defend and advance America's national interest, not to defend and advance Trump's personal relationships.
So how much, in your opinion, is Trump policy toward Russia not in the interest of the United States?
Well, here's the paradox. I actually think the Trump administration's policy towards Russia is pretty good. I think it actually there's a lot of continuity between Obama administration policy and Trump administration policy. Both, by the way, Obama people and Trump people won't like that I just said that, but if you dig in and you look at it, there's a lot of continuity. Sanctions on businesses because of what they did in Ukraine, bolstering NATO, supporting Ukraine, and I think that's really important. That's the ideological battleground state in the world. But President Trump doesn't always support the Trump administration's policy towards Russia, and that disconnect is where you have confusion about what they're trying to do vis-a-vis Russia.
My guest, President Obama's ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul, with a new book, From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. And we can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's stay on Ukraine, because I know you think
Great. That's
really important.
I was just there last week.
Really. And a turning point in U.S. Putin relations was the overthrow of a Russian-backed leader
yes.
in Ukraine, who I saw you say on Meet the Press yesterday, we didn't overthrow. But why was that so important?
Well, I do think it was a turning point. I think it was the place where you could never go back to close relations with Putin. And here's why. In the fall of 2013, President Yanukovych, the president at the time in Ukraine, made a decision to not sign an agreement, an association agreement with the European Union, and was signaling he was going to move closer to Putin. But some small D Democrats, right, people in Ukraine thought that was a really bad idea. The leader of the group was a guy named Mustafa Naim, and he went on to Facebook and said, this is outrageous. We're a European country. If you agree with me, come to Maidan, and we're going to protest this. And tens of thousands of people showed up, and you had a standoff between the regime and the street. the street wanting a more pro-Western policy. You had some tragedy. People got shot by the government. Hundreds of people died. And we, the Obama administration, despite all that, we tried to help negotiate a deal between President Yanukovych and the opposition leaders. And I remember it vividly. February 21st, 2014, I was at the Sochi Olympics at the time. I got a text saying we had a deal, and there was all this congratulations going on, and we're going to prevent a big standoff here. 6 hours later, Yanukovych fled the country, showed up in Russia. We didn't understand why he left, but Putin, he blamed us. It's the CIA again doing regime change against my ally. And this time he struck back. First, he took Crimea. And when that was easy, he went into eastern Ukraine. And I think that was the beginning of this very confrontational period ever since.
Why were we even involved in that at all? There are people on the left, not just Putin apologists, who will say, if we didn't remain so aggressive in Europe after the end of the Cold War, maybe this incident included, then Russia wouldn't have fell back on its heels vis-a-vis the United States, and Putin would never have become Putin.
It's an important argument. I think we should have done more to help build democracy and markets and take off the edge of what was a horrible depression, three times worse than our depression in the 1990s. And we missed a big opportunity then. But I want to add something. After all those things happened, NATO expansion, the bombing of Serbia, the war in Iraq, which were all tensions and created tensions in U.S.-Russian relations, after all that, we had the period of the reset. For 4 years between Obama and Medvedev, where at the end of it, 60% of Russians had a positive view of the United States. About the same number of Americans had a positive view of Russia. And in my 5 years in government, I was in most meetings with Obama and Medvedev and Putin, oftentimes on the phone. Issues like NATO expansion had disappeared.
And before we leave Ukraine, the Republican Party position was anti-Russia in Ukraine.
Yes.
And when Paul Manafort was campaign manager during the platform writing portion of the convention,
yes,
the language flipped to pro-Russia in Ukraine. What relationship between the Trump campaign and Russia does that expose, if any, in your opinion?
Well, I'm waiting for Mr. Mueller to complete his work because there are some very unusual things that happened. And most certainly Paul Manafort had some deep relationships with pro-Russian Ukrainian officials, including President Yanukovych, who we were just talking about. Lots of strange meetings here in your city in New York between Russians and Trump campaign officials. There's no doubt in my mind that Putin wanted Trump to win and he wanted Clinton to lose because Trump, very rationally, by the way, Trump said on the campaign trail, I'm going to look into recognizing Crimea as part of Russia and lifting sanctions and beating up on NATO. And by the way, Trump never said anything about democracy and human rights. Clinton said the opposite. So he wanted him to win. He tried to help him to win. There's no doubt in my mind. Whether or not he worked to coordinate that assistance with the Trump campaign, that's what we need the Mueller investigation to uncover for us.
And you were in Moscow 2012 to 2014. Is that accurate?
Yes.
So that includes 2013,
correct,
the year when Trump was in Moscow and, you know, all the stuff from the dossier either happened or didn't happen. Do you think Putin has something on Trump?
Well, I know the Ritz-Carlton well. I know how that system works in terms of gathering intelligence. They have incredible capabilities. I had to live as ambassador with the thought that every email I sent, every phone call I made, every movement I made in my house, Spasa House, was being recorded. Think about that for a minute. Every movement I made.
Some way to live.
It's a hard way to live. And the Ritz-Carlton, just I'll tell you a story from the book. We traveled to Moscow in July 2009 with President Obama. We stayed at the Ritz-Carlton, the entire White House entourage, to create the possibility for a confidential conversation with the president. We built it looked like a submarine. Every piece we shipped from the United States, and we built it in one of the suites in the Ritz-Carlton so that we could crawl inside there to talk to the president so that we wouldn't be recorded. Hmm. So anything that happens in the Ritz-Carlton, they have the capacity to record. There's no doubt in my mind about that. What actually happened, of course, I'm going to lead for others.
Pat in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to see what the guests would say as far as the seeds for the current political structure in Russia being planted by, you know, the United States and the West in the attempt to keep Yeltsin from losing the election in 96, where basically that was done by turning over everything to the oligarchs and letting them throw all their money that they had just gotten and all the privatization to do anything so that Yeltsin wouldn't lose. And that kind of laid the ground for what Russia is dealing with right now.
It's a great question. And I was going to ask a version of that question, too, that includes, did the U.S. meddle in the election of 1996 in Russia on behalf of Boris Yeltsin? And if so, is that any better than the way Russia meddled in our election in 2016?
Yeah, Pat, thanks for the question. It is a good question. And I talk about it in detail in the book. So go buy the book because we won't have time to get into the details. Here's what I would say. Most certainly, the Clinton administration had a preference for Boris Yeltsin winning that election, and I talk about it very bluntly. They didn't want to see Zhuganov, the communist leader, win that election. You know, in my own view, I've talked about it and I think about it, and retrospectively, maybe had Zhuganov won and you would have a turnover of power, that might have been better than not. But that's a counterfactual. Huh. Because I don't think he would have destroyed the economy and all the horror stories that we talked about in 96.
Wouldn't have gone back to Marxism, Stalinism.
I don't think so. He's still living there today, and he enjoys capitalism too, by the way. I used to deal with Mr. Zhuganov as ambassador. Did we help provide financial assistance to the Russian government at that time? The answer to that is yes. So you might say we were helping Yeltsin. Did we provide the campaign consultants that has been written about famously? The answer to that is no. President Clinton had nothing to do with that. They were private people from California, by the way, hired by the Yeltsin team to come in as campaign consultants. My own assessment of their work is they had very little to do with the outcome. It was actually Anatoly Chubais, who didn't talk to them, who ran that campaign. But they were outside consultants hired for help. I do think it raises a big ethical and moral question for all democracies. Should that be allowed to happen? It does all over the world today. My own view is that there should be more regulation about what outsiders do during elections, including our own election.
More regulation. I guess there are some in the world who could argue that if the U.S. is the sole superpower or the dominant superpower ever since the Cold War, that other countries really have an interest in what U.S. policy is.
They do.
And so Russia or anyone else participating in the U.S. election in some way is actually not the most illegitimate thing in the world.
Well, they most certainly have an interest. They most certainly have their lobby groups. They most certainly come with their representatives to lobby on their behalf. Because you're right, our policy affects the entire world. So you want to be involved in that in a democratic way. However, I believe we have campaign laws that say you as a foreigner cannot give money to a candidate. I think that's a good thing. I think we Americans should have the sovereign right to choose our own leaders. That was violated in 2016 by the way that things were manipulated here and people that misrepresented them. And so I think we need to be more vigilant, especially with respect to what social media companies do, because that was a new frontier that I think surprised a lot of people. And I hope we get it right by the next election.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Do you have an opinion as a former diplomat about Trump's approach to North Korea? Could it be it really was his talking about Little Rocket Man and my nuclear button is bigger than yours that has brought them to talking about denuclearization, even though it doesn't sound nice in polite company?
Well, I don't know, obviously. I want to make sure I underscore that. And I don't believe anybody that claims they know. I want to underscore that point, too. But I do know there are lots of cases, historical cases, and we call it coercive diplomacy, that the threat of force leads to the permissive conditions for a breakthrough. I think we're really early in this drama, and I am not optimistic it's going to lead to the end of nuclear weapons in North Korea. But I applaud the president for trying. There's nothing to be lost in trying to gain that. And surprising things happened. The end of the Cold War, after all, happened after Ronald Reagan, for years and years, talked about the Soviet Union as the evil empire and built up threats. He then later found a friend in Mikhail Gorbachev. And I, you know, that's the first chapter in my book. I think that personal relationship between Reagan and Gorbachev was one of the really drivers of the end of the Cold War.
If what Kim Jong-un might propose is they'll denuclearize for real if the United States withdraws its nuclear umbrella, quote unquote, over, you know, Japan and South Korea and our other allies there, is that a deal we should take?
We could get close to a deal like that. I mean, the notion of a nuclear umbrella withdrawing is a little bit – I mean, that's the conversation. But realize we can launch nuclear weapons from the United States of America, from Montana and North Dakota, and they can reach North Korea. But those contours, I think, are right. One of the paradoxes, though, and it's coming up this week, is I would love to get something with North Korea like we have with Iran. The problem is our president right now is undermining that deal, and I think that undermines his credibility in his negotiations with the North Koreans.
And we'll be getting views of that all week. In 15 seconds, does Russia have an interest in how North Korea turns out one way or another?
Putin would like to be more engaged. He doesn't like to be on the sidelines, and I think that's driving him nuts.
On the side of peace or the side of conflict?
On the side of peace.
Michael McFaul's new book is called, of course I misplaced it, so why don't you say it? From Cold War to Hot Peace, an American ambassador in Putin's Russia. And listeners, there will be an event if you want to see Ambassador McFaul in person. You have to wake up early in the morning. It's at 8 o'clock on Wednesday at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs on East 64th Street. That's a $25 ticket, but 8 a.m. on Wednesday. For McFaul at Carnegie Council, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.